The following program has been provided by the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project. For more information, call 1-800-735-0230 or log on to pacificaradioarchives.org.
In the following program, entitled They Wouldn't Go to War, two young men at a public meeting sponsored by the East Bay Women for Peace describe their resistance to the war in Vietnam. The speakers are Malcolm Dundas, just released from 14 months in prison for refusing alternative service, and Oliver Hirsch, one of the 9 servicemen for peace who chained themselves to clergymen in a Marin church and resigned from the Air Force. The meeting was recorded in Berkeley on October 2, 1968. The first speaker is Oliver Hirsch.
Okay. I think perhaps... It might be perhaps valuable to some people if I talked about the kind of changes that I went through, because I think you can see them taking place more and more openly now within the military. After I'd been in the military about 1.5 years and I'd progressed very well as a dehumanized individual, I began to think of myself in terms of human beings, and I started thinking of other human beings in the same terms. And just from that kind of outlook, things began to change immediately. I think a realization that came that I perhaps had been feeling the effect of or feeling hints at was the decision that I could not and that I would not kill. That was, I think, the hardest one, but I think that was the most important realization of my life. Because when I realized that, I began to see my role in the Air Force or in the military at all as something that was going to be awfully difficult or perhaps even impossible to cope with. So as soon as I began to expose things that to myself that were not in line with this first revelation, things started happening. My job with the Air Force was aircraft control and warning through ground control, through radar control of aircraft. I was training interceptor pilots and bomber pilots. And I thought a bit about that, and no matter how hard I tried to rationalize it, it came down to the fact that I was holding an awfully big gun. I hadn't seen the faces of anyone I'd killed, but I was holding an awfully big gun. So I thought, well, perhaps I can just get out of my job. Perhaps I can do something constructive. And as I progressed, as I went through this introspection, rather painful introspection, it came down to the fact that just by wearing a uniform, I was acquiescing to America's role in Vietnam. I could talk all I wanted against it, but when it came down to nitty-gritty, I was wearing the uniform, and I was acquiescing, therefore, to what was happening in Vietnam. So I thought, well, okay, then for your own life, the military has to be stopped. I have to get out for myself. So being still pretty shaky on my newfound legs, I decided I was going to seek the least obnoxious way out of the military. And at the time, of all the different avenues of escape, I thought that perhaps feigning a mental imbalance would be the easiest. And I'm really glad I did it, because I was able to see in a very, very heavy course of 2 months in an army psychiatric ward the refined evil that exists in this country. And I don't think you can, within this country, I think you'll have to go a long way to find it as bad and as refined and as clear-cut as you will in an army psychiatric ward. The majority of my fellow inmates were emotional or mental cripples who were sent back from Vietnam for rehabilitation. And the sort of tactics that the Army uses to try to bring these people not just back to being human beings, but tries to bring them back to the point where they can be good, red-blooded American killers for the Army. really brought home to me exactly what it was that I was fighting. I've talked to a few doctors since I've left Ward S1, and there is no way that I can prove any of the things I saw, but if I can just give you a hint of some of the things that went on. I understand from psychiatrists that shock treatment was used several years ago punitively, but that it was decided that it was a highly inhumane thing to do. Well, it still goes on, and it goes on in the Army psychiatric ward for people who won't cooperate. This kind of thing brought me to the realization, and talking to an Army psychiatrist who supposedly had taken the Hippocratic Oath but nonetheless was churning out rehabilitated killers every day, I think my contact with him was very influential. And after spending 2 months of the rigmarole of trying to convince him that perhaps I wasn't the best psychiatrically equipped person to handle military duty, I decided that I could just no longer justify my trying to play a game with an organization that was capable of such evil. So at the early part of June, I went AWOL from that, from the psychiatric ward, with absolutely no plans at all, just to get away from that for a while and get myself together. And I realized after a few days AWOL that the only thing that I could morally do was to confront the military with my decisions and confront them as an adult, as a responsible person, and tell them exactly where I was and why I was there and what it meant to them. So on the 15th of June, I joined 8 other guys who had, through various roads, come to the same decision, and we made public announcements that we resigned. And I was charged with desertion, supposed to have 3.5 years, and through various political maneuvers, I was released after 42 days. Perhaps if I can just take a minute to add a little light to that sort of thing. The Air Force is a draft dodger organization. People who don't particularly relish the idea of killing or particularly feel that it's a good idea to die for their country usually end up in the Air Force if they decide that they aren't going to confront the system. The Air Force is aware of the fact that its largest percentage of human bodies comes from that category, the draft dodger. And with the publicity they got from our original confrontation, they were a little bit uncomfortable, and I think they saw an opportunity to stage somewhat of a political coup, a publicity coup, by releasing me. And that's why I think they did it. But I don't think they've fooled very many people. At least people who are inside can keep spreading the word that this just isn't the Air Force's mode of operation. The stockades are packed with political prisoners, people who've said that they will no longer fight, will no longer participate at all, will no longer wear a uniform, and will not cooperate as far as filling out conscientious objector papers or whatever. And they're serving terms in the Air Force stockades, and the Air Force stockades are filled to overflowing. I was in a one-man cell, and as I was leaving, every one-man cell at the Hamilton Air Force Base stockade had a bunk bed in it with two guys in it. It's hopeful. So now I'm working for the War Resisters League as a military counselor. I feel sort of equipped, perhaps. I'm not yet educated to know the legal and the regulations as well as I could, and I hopefully that will come within the next few months. But I think I can sympathize with where an AWOL GI's head is. And we're getting a lot of AWOL GI's, and this is where I think you can help. People are coming, some of them aren't sure of what they're going to do. A lot of them feel that a confrontation is in order, and it'd be safe to say that there's going to be another 9 for Peace type demonstration within the very near future. But we have many more AWOLs coming through our office than appear on front pages. We have people who could no longer put up with it and who feel, after looking at themselves and evaluating themselves, that they cannot stand up under any sort of a prison situation. So we're helping them. What we need is housing for these people, places where they can go and just be treated like a human being so that they can start thinking like human beings and perhaps start making plans for their lives as human beings. And for those people who do make a confrontation, we need support, and we need an awful lot of support. I think through the 9 for Peace thing, it's been shown that the public keeping an eye on the kind of treatment that GIs get within the stockades really has a lot to do with the way they are treated. If the Army thinks that they can get away with the brutal behavior, well, they'll do it. But if the Army's aware of the fact that there's lawyers and clergymen and responsible members of the community watching, not just irresponsible hippies, but responsible people in the community watching, then it's going to affect their behavior. So when we do have a confrontation, we need letters, we need calls, we need people to show up at court martials. So if anyone is interested in helping in this particular area and helping the GIs once they're AWOL and once they've returned to military custody, get in contact with us at the War Resisters League, and we'll tell you exactly where to lend your support. Thank you.
The speaker you have just heard was Oliver Hirsch. The talk you are about to hear is by Malcolm Dundas, who was just released after spending 14 months in prison for refusing alternative service.
Well, if I had 400 days, I don't think I could get through all of what I feel needs to be said and needs to be done, even in this very short period of time that I feel we have to work on. I think the best thing to do is sort of put in perspective my own personal changes from what I considered a fair-weather liberal into what I consider myself now to be, which is a radical. And what I mean by radical is a person who is never satisfied with the way things are, and that things have to be constantly changed and moved and pushed and prodded, and that there is no plateau on which you can rest. And I think that's the basic difference between myself and someone like Hubert Humphrey, who makes a lot of beautiful liberal statements, or someone like Eugene McCarthy, who apologizes for American policies in Vietnam, offers us amnesty, but doesn't attack the basic problem of why people like myself are in jail. He offers us amnesty, but he doesn't offer to end or abolish the conscription system and the military-industrial complex, or stop the brutal, senseless system of war and exploitation that goes on not only in Vietnam, but in Guatemala, in Bolivia, in Africa, in Europe, and everywhere else that America has its interest. And I think, to back this up, I think I should change from where I came from and up to where I think I am now. For a long time, I think every one of us has read the history books of America that were given to us in grade school, in the eighth grade, and then in college and so forth, which told us of this wonderful country, of this group of draft dodgers who came here, who built a free country, and then immediately set out to persecute and prosecute those who disagreed with them. But the history books don't go on to tell that America moved from a position of being a basic defender of human rights into one, especially in the last 100 years, where it has been a destroyer of human rights in practically every country we can think of in the world. From the era of McKinley on, when we invaded several areas from the Philippines to Mexico, and until the present era in the 1940s with the deals we made with Churchill, so that we felt that in the Second World War, for instance, that if Germany and Russia fought, then America wouldn't have to get involved, because the two biggest threats to our, not to our freedom, but to our security as a world power would be destroyed by each other. But it didn't work out that way. To the Korean War, where we used an illegal action in the United Nations to base our expanding our territorial empire into Korea, into the present conflict in Vietnam, where we backed a racist and backward French government into an era of Diem, which was a man who was born in this country, and we backed him again. And then in Guatemala, where we backed the United Fruit Company, in Cuba, where we backed the sugar interests rather than the struggle of the people, and right down to the Dominican crisis in 1965, when we sent the Marines in rather than lose Averill Harriman's interests in the Dominican Republic. In my own personal experience, I moved from a college liberal into the Peace Corps, into realizing how really rotten the American policies are, especially in the area where I was in Africa, where there's tremendous amount of difference between what is and what is told, where the State Department tells you one day that no, we didn't send the bombers into the Congo, and the next day tells you yes, we did. And in February of 65, when I was first arrived in East Africa, and under a pledge of peace, Johnson had said in 1964, we will not bomb the northern sector of Vietnam. We will end this war as quickly as possible. Johnson, on February 7th of 1965, sent the bombers into the northern sector of Vietnam. And there, I think my first radical crisis, my change from a liberal to a radical, came at that point. I decided at that point that even to subscribe to the Peace Corps, no matter how humane and beautiful its ends might be, that given the amount of money that was being bombed into the Vietnamese day after day, the Peace Corps was meaningless. That whatever money they spent per year was far outweighed in 1 hour of bombing in Vietnam. So from that point until the time that I actually refused, I think I became more and more a radical person. Until that Peace Corps experience, I'd tried using the channels that the government offered me. I'd written letters, I'd thought and argued and gone through their channels, and found that, as far as I was concerned anyway, that the channels just didn't work. From there, I moved to nonviolent direct action with the Committee for Nonviolent Action, and then into a direct confrontation with people who had been in the South, who had been in jail in the Second World War, people who had, with their lives, had made some kind of commitment. And then, as I mentioned to the audience earlier, this young man, Roger LaPorte, in 66, burned himself in front of the United Nations building. And if anything moved me more, I think that was it. I think if anything, that this young man who had everything that America had to offer, who had come out of the same basic background as I had burned himself, not in a protest, but in the hopes that America would heal its wounds and come together and stop burning and mutilating children in Vietnam and elsewhere in the country. And any suffering that I felt that I would go through in jail was irrelevant compared to what this man had given. He'd given everything he felt he could. So what I'm saying is it started out with a disillusionment with what the present status quo in America was, to a point where I came to the decision that I had to personally confront an inhuman, an unethical, an immoral system with myself. That was the only weapon I had left as a white person. That guns weren't going to work, that cooperating with the system wasn't going to work, because any part of that system, any deferment, any special status, was the result directly of my privileged status as a white person in this country. That to take a CO position, as I had, was to say it was all right for them to fill up my slot with hundreds of black and brown and red people in this country. That those that didn't have the education, didn't have the time to think out these things, should go and kill in my place. And I said, no, this can't happen. And through that period, I also worked with the strike and with other black and brown organizations. And I began to realize that the real fight, if real changes were going to have to come, that I was going to have to get out of the ghettos, as they were called, out of the brown areas of America, and into my own ghetto, into the suburban areas, because that's where the people have got to move. Because American white liberal people for so long have told other people how to live, and they've also dwelt in this prison so long, this prison of affluence, which is probably the biggest prison of all, for so long that they don't know how to act anymore. They don't realize to themselves that they're really in prison. So in April 20th, I went up before the federal court of Alfonso Joseph Zerpoli in San Francisco, in which we had a little tete-a-tete amounting to about 3 hours of a federal trial, in which any legal defense I tried to present before this man was ruled out as a matter of law, which could not be argued before the courts. I tried the Nuremberg decisions, I tried the 13th Amendment, which prohibits involuntary servitude, I tried several other legal avenues. And the only evidence that the courts will permit you to bring in defense of yourself is your selective service file or evidence that they've already permitted. So at that court, I read the same statement I'd presented to my board when I refused alternative service. And then on May 17, 1967, I was sentenced to 18 months in the federal, in other words, turned over to the jurisdiction of the Attorney General of the United States to any institution which he deemed necessary for my rehabilitation or for my help. I spent a month in the San Francisco County Jail, and then I was transferred to the Federal Correctional Institution at Lone Park, California, which is near Vandenberg Air Force Base, Santa Maria, Santa Barbara, in that area. This prison, which is the only name I can think of it for it in my terms, is a medium security prison. It's for people under the age of 25, mostly. It has two fences, it has five gun towers, and it has a program in which they say they're going to rehabilitate people much the same the way the military does. They have a hospital, they have one psychiatrist for 1,100 inmates, they have one psychologist for 1,100 inmates, they have two doctors for 1,100 inmates, two dentists for 1,100 inmates, and three medical technical assistants for 1,100 inmates. They have about 8 caseworkers who handle an average load of 200 to 300 cases. The average sentence there is 6 years, which is what they call the Youth Corrections Act, which takes away not only your youth, which is the first aim, I think, of this thing. It's an indefinite sentence. A man is sentenced under this act on the euphemism that he will be given a misdemeanor once his 6 years is up. So what the federal government does, I think that this is a sidetrack, but I think it's important to understand the way the federal system works. They take a man, they charge him with 20 charges, like sales, possession of dope, and so forth and so on, until they have about 20 charges against him, which they know they can't possibly prove. And the first word they know is when they meet the attorney of this young kid, they say, all right, we'll make a deal. And the minute they make that, say that word, you should know by now that they don't have a shred of evidence against you. But the lawyer playing the same basic game says, all right, we'll go ahead. And they make a deal and they sentence this man to 6 years in a correctional institution. He's sent to a place like Lone Park. If he has no high school education, he has to get a high school education. He has to take a trade. He has to conform to the rules and regulations of that institution, which are very similar to the military. He has to do everything that they say, and he can't step out of line. If he refuses to take high school or any of these things, he can be kept up to 4 years without parole. And this the average age of a man entering that under that sentence is 18 to 19. So that means he could spend up until the age of 23 or 24 in jail before he's even seeing daylight. They've also, by the way, also sentenced several draft refusers to that case. This sentence was set up to rehabilitate people, is what it was, so that people wouldn't be criminals anymore. In other words, they'd become good mechanics or something like this. But the problem is that there's 75% returnee on this sentence, so you can't even talk about rehabilitation. It's set up in a prison which is totally isolated from any community at all. The only community they know is the guards and the inmates themselves. All right, this is the kind of place I was sent to. Now, there's been a lot of talk amongst ladies' groups and amongst some resistance people about sending us to camps because then we wouldn't have to be with all those dirty criminals. Well, I think the first thing I realized from the first day I got into any jail at all was that there is no difference between us and the other prisoners. That once you put on that uniform, or once that you are booked, there is no difference. Whether the prisoners or the guards realize that, as far as I'm concerned, and most of the political prisoners, that there is no difference. That we're all in there for one, that we're all in there because of a failure of a system to operate efficiently, a failure of a system to operate justly is a better word than efficiently. That by and large, most of the cases in jails now, if they had $5,000 on the books, to their credit, would not be in the jail right now. Anybody that has a good lawyer, I mean a really good lawyer, not a shyster or a crook like a lot of them are, but a really good lawyer could find a legal loophole to get out of jail. But the man who has to rely on a public defender, who is usually a prosecutor, a retired prosecutor.
Due to a change in tapes, the tail end of Mr. Dundas' last sentence was lost. That sentence would have concluded with the words, "But the man who has to rely on a public prosecutor is dead." Since several more words are missing, we will now begin playing the tape again, resuming Mr. Dundas' talk in mid-sentence.
Prison will point out the very core and heart of the failure of the American system, because by and large the people that are in jail are black or brown. And it is there that most of them get their education. It is there that most of them really understand for the first time what this system is all about. And I think as more and more white kids, white intellectual kids, start going to jail or get put in jail because of the system, they will begin to understand, as I did, that the system can't be reformed, that it has to be abolished, torn down, destroyed, whatever word you want to use. That what we need in this country is not reforms anymore, but a revolution. And hopefully that this revolution will come with the white people moving first. Otherwise, as Baldwin said a long time ago, it's the fire next time. And if we don't get it right now, I mean, it isn't put off till next year. It isn't a matter of waiting four more days or until we get a new coat or a new car. It's a matter of doing it right now. But those prisons are only a symbol of what the prison on the outside is. That when I got outside, I wasn't getting out to freedom. I was getting out to a much bigger prison. That the prison out here is just not as obvious as it is inside Lompoc, where you can look out your window and see two fences, five gun towers, and a guard with a carbine ready to shoot you if you even get anywhere near that fence. But if you don't believe that you're in a prison out here, try and exercise any human rights here. Try and say no to anything this system says. Refuse to pay taxes one day and see whether you have freedom in this country. Refuse to do anything in this country. Refuse to serve in the military and see how long you last in this country. Say, "I don't want to do things this way anymore," and you'll realize how closed a system we're in. Now, I think, too, that a lot of people who have come to me, young people, talking about, well, what are prisons like? What kind of suffering am I going to have to go through? I think what we have to do is start putting this suffering in perspective, one, to the Vietnamese kids that are being burned every day, two, to the black and brown and red people in this country who are being destroyed every day by the cops and by the forces that we have built and lent our assent to silently in most cases. By this I mean the affluence that we enjoy as white people is a direct result of the enslavement. And I use the word very realistically, the enslavement of three-quarters of the world. America's freedom of movement, Europe's freedom of movement, is a direct result of the American system, and it is the American system is able to maintain itself as long as three-quarters of the black and brown and red people and yellow people in this world are kept down. So when somebody comes up to me and asks, well, how bad is it in prison? I say, well, it's a prison, you know. There isn't much else I can say because prisons, the way you react to prisons are so individual. But I think first that they have to understand in a perspective what their suffering is going to mean. The suffering has to be seen in light of the kind of suffering that is going on day after day in Vietnam or day after day in the black ghetto. That the kind of risk you're taking up to 5 years in jail is nothing. You know, really nothing in comparison to the kind of suffering that goes on minute after minute or day after day in any part of this country within 5 miles of this place, within 2 miles of this place, or 10,000 miles of this place. And spending 18 months in a federal mother's nursery is not going to hurt you that much. And the kind of things that have to come first in terms of people changing to the point where they'll even risk jail is first they have to get a personal awareness of where they're at. You know, you have to understand that you're in prison first, right out here. And then you have to see, well, what ways can I go to change? All right, most people start with the channels first. They go through channels, then they go through disillusionment, and then they go through a personal confrontation. And I think the more understanding and education you have, the more you realize that the only thing left for you to do is to say no. And you say no in order to say yes to a lot of other things. Because if you don't say no to taxes, if you don't say no to war, and if you don't say no to the military conscription system, and if you don't say no to the military-industrial complex which uses and abuses your life, which sends you anywhere they want to, and destroys your life, it destroys your freedom of thought and action, then you can't even begin to say yes about love or peace or being one with another or living in your communities or living in your hippie or whatever other thing you're in. Now I think finally one of the most beautiful things that has come out of the resistance thing is that once that people have got to the up to the point of having the courage to say no to a totally amorphous system is the sense of community that they feel. That these young men that go to jail or are willing to risk jail have a sense of bond and community that can't be broken. That the people I met in prison, both the regular political prisoners and the other political prisoners, by which I mean all the prisoners, is a bond that can't be broken. That the community we feel one for another, no matter what happens, no matter whether we see each other ever again, is something that can't be broken. And from that community, once we're out, will grow a whole new society, hopefully. A revolutionary society, a building and a beginning of a radical society that will not allow this to happen to our children or to anyone else's children. And I think the only thing that holds most people back from acting at all is the little word, four-letter word of fear. And if we put this fear into perspective, it is no longer a stumbling block because everybody is afraid. I was afraid, you know, I was afraid the time they slammed the door on me. I was afraid every morning when the doors opened again in the jail. And I was afraid from the time I resisted. Well, you have to start acting. You have to act on as much as you know, even if you don't know all the facts. There's a point at which you have to act. And whether it's sage or wise or political, as Martin Luther King says, there's a point at which you have to act on your conscience. And your conscience is your own awareness of what is and what is right and what is wrong. And when you start acting on that, then you have overcome fear and you've begun to be a human being again. Because once you have said no, you have broken down the dehumanization of the system. You have become a human being again, and you're acting as a free agent. No matter where they put your body in a physical prison, you are a free agent. But until you say no, you really can't even talk about being free, because you're not free.
That was Malcolm Dundas addressing the East Bay Women for Peace. The program you have just heard, entitled They Wouldn't Go to War, was recorded for KPFA by Ted Levy and was produced by John Berger.